Right. I'm thrilled that you are here with me. I always like to start a session by saying, you know, if we had had something like this several years ago, there might have been two ladies in the room who said, oh, I want to learn a little bit about how to share with Muslim women. God is doing an amazing thing in our time. I think more and more we're seeing interest and love and care for Muslim women, and I hope in one little short hour that we have together, we can share with each other what we know about Muslim women, but also learn a few things and a few ways and about how to share with them, but more than that, how to love them and realize that they are children of God that He died for. How many of you have Muslim friends? All right. Are these in America or overseas? Both. Good. All right. How many of you know of Muslims on your campus? All right. Good. As you looked at the pictures of our ladies that went through the screen earlier, what came to your mind?
Beauty.
Yeah, they are very beautiful. Even if all you see is their eyes, there's something pretty about their eyes, isn't it? What else?
How simple they are.
All right. You want to share a little bit more?
Like, every time I would look at a picture, they weren't doing much, and then they just, I don't know, the way that the things they were doing, they seemed so patient, just, the simplicity of how they were doing the things they were doing.
Great insight.
Hardworking,
yeah. Caring. Mm-hmm. Very hardworking. All right. Other things that popped into your mind?
Sadness.
Yeah. Talk a bit about that.
I lived in Turkey for 3 years and saw the sometimes what they were hiding were bruises, because there were so many of them were beaten by their husbands and fathers.
Yeah. Those pictures brought stories to your mind of individuals, yeah. So true. Welcome. What else came to your mind? Were they all alike? Yeah. They didn't dress alike. I mean, bright colors, and then you come to women in the hijabs and baltos. So lots of variety. Other thoughts?
There seemed just like, sort of in the eyes, like there's all this unspoken, like, I don't know, things that they think or feel but that they don't really say, just kind of like a depth to them that you wouldn't necessarily, they would never communicate, I guess.
That's a great, great thought, yeah. So it's an idea that if you're just an acquaintance, you're not going to really know who they are. That's so true. Yeah.
I agree with that. It's a sense of bravery. Like, they try to move on with their lives even though they have that sadness behind them that you don't see. They still try to live life as normal.
Yeah, there's a very much a tenacity among them that they keep on. All right, any other thoughts? I want to hear your thoughts, and then we'll share some of the things that will guide us through this. The way we're going to do it, first of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about their worldview, and then we're going to move into what are some of the barriers. So what I want you to do is, as you're listening to me talk about their worldview, I want you to think, what are some of the reasons that it's hard to share Christ with them through what I talk about? And then we're going to go to what are some of the bridges of how can we take what we've heard and jump off and really allow Christ to enter into the conversation as we meet Muslim women. I think one of the things I love about Muslim women is they're not afraid to ask you anything. There is no fear. They're going to ask you lots of questions. They may be the most bizarre questions in the world. And they are constantly trying to share their faith with you. They think nothing of talking about who they are, because Islam is so much a part of their lives. And they wonder why we don't share what's so precious to us. So I hope that gives you a boldness. They are a beautiful group of ladies. And I think as you see them, they're all different. I like to describe them like you're going into a Baskin-Robbins ice cream store, and there's at least 33 flavors. Some weeks I think they have more. And that's exactly who Muslim women are. If you go to Asia, they are very different than the Muslim women who are in West Africa. And the Muslim women of the Middle East are very different from the Muslim women in sub-Saharan Africa. But the common thread that runs through all of that is that they are Muslim. They are part of Islam. There are about 1.2 billion people on the planet who are governed by Islam. And it's estimated, and this gives you a picture of where the light blue is where they are the highest population. Have any of you been to any of those countries in the light blue? Can you share where you were?
I was during the Morocco.
In Morocco.
Turkey, Egypt.
That's why you look familiar.
Yeah.
Nice to see you. All right. So you have lots to add, so please add.
Listen to her.
1 in 10 persons in the world is a Muslim woman. So we have a great opportunity, and I hope that gives you encouragement that God has said, for some reason, Muslim women are not going to hear about Jesus from my husband or from the men on my team or even from their husbands if they are followers of Jesus. It's up to women. So that is our task. Don't you love this? I've never seen anybody wear that outfit, but apparently that's a very common outfit several hundred years ago, about 100 years ago. You know, women cover, and that's what we know about Muslim women a lot of times. Those of you who have Muslim friends, what do you love about them? Muslim women friends, I guess, is what's something you really love about them? What are some characteristics?
They're very gentle. And very compassionate.
Yeah. And they'll if you're sick, they're going to be at your door. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they lay down what they're doing for you. Other things you love about them? Anybody love how they're hospitable? That's probably their highest quality, is they do know how to do hospitality. We'll talk about that in a minute. But let me mention just a few things. And remember, you're listening for barriers of why it's going to be harder to maybe share with them than some other people that live near you. They live in community. Women always are in community. You will rarely see a Muslim woman out by herself. Now, in a college situation where you are and they're an exchange student or they're attending your university, there are times that they'll be by themselves, which will cause them maybe to feel a little uneasy because all of their life they have lived in community. You will rarely see them in a, you know, out traveling by themselves. They'll be with somebody else. One of my friends told me when she grew up, it was the job of her brother to make sure that she remained pure. And so everywhere she went, he had to follow her or he had to be there. And she said, she described it as if he was like a big old dog that was always near her and she could never get away from him. But that was his responsibility because in his and their world, the honor of the family is the most important thing. And to do something that would dishonor or shame your family is horrible. And you may have heard about honor killings, and this is what happens a lot of times. Even if the girl has done nothing wrong, but reputation follows her back to her father or her uncle, then honor killings can take place if she has brought any kind of dishonor to the family. In the family, she is part of a community there. Usually the father, the uncles, the male members of the family are the ones in charge of the family. But when she marries, do you know where she might go live? Do any of you know, have an idea where she might live once she's married? In the house of her husband's mother. So you can imagine living with under the rule of your mother-in-law. And many Muslim women, their prayer in life is that they will have male children because that means he will get married and bring home someone who can finally help her keep the house going. Many young brides get into this situation where they pretty much become the slave of the mother-in-law. She pretty much tells them, I need tea at this time, and I want this, and she sends her running quickly to do tasks for her. But the honor of the family is so important. Most Muslim women, and it's interesting, John Sapp shared it, my husband shared it, that these women are oral communicators. They both have talked about being oral people. And they may be the most educated women in their community, but they communicate mostly through stories. They love stories. They'll sit for hours in their home, and you know, they're watching television. The television, if they have one, is usually on all the time. They get really sucked into dramas and soap operas. During Ramadan, does everybody know what Ramadan is? Anybody not know? Don't be embarrassed. Okay, Ramadan is the month each year where they fast for the entire month from the when the moon, which way does the moon go? The moon's, which way is it? The moon is a sliver of a moon. They'll begin to fast, and they fast for 30 days. They eat after dark. So during the nighttime hours, they're eating. And women during this time, it's a hard job to be a woman, a Muslim woman during Ramadan, because she's expected to have meals prepared when the sun goes down, and they feast. And then before the sun comes up, then they feast. So she pretty much cooks a lot during that time. But they would sit and watch soap operas. They have special soap operas that come out during Ramadan. And you'll notice in their homes, they break the fast, they eat their meal, and then they all gather around the TV to follow the soap opera of the Ramadan month. But they love stories. They communicate through drama and stories. If you ever go to their house, and it would be similar to this, their living area would be similar. In many wealthy Muslim areas, there'll be a sitting room for women and a sitting room for men, and you would never combine the two. In your more moderate Muslim areas, they would sit together with men and women, but they prefer not to, because you never see a Muslim woman. It's very embarrassed to be around any other man that's not in her family. But they'll sit and they'll tell stories, and they like to tell stories to outdo each other. And so they will tell the weirdest stories. And you wonder, are these true stories or are they making these up? But it doesn't matter, because they'll all finish the story and everybody say, oh, that's a good one, but, and then they'll start telling. And so they'll spend hours telling stories. There's another clue for you of some way that is a barrier and a bridge to sharing the gospel. They're different globally across the globe. In Asia, more women are in the workforce. More Muslim women are out in working areas, business, educators. In your more severe Muslim countries, they will not be seen out of their houses. They will rarely travel anywhere by themselves, and never outside by themselves for sure. The first time I went to Yemen, the big thing that hit me was how few women were on the street. There were hundreds of men, and I only saw maybe one or two women on the street. And they were busily getting to where they needed to be. They did not linger, like in the market and whatever. Just a funny story. In Yemen, the men are the salesmen. And when women go to buy clothes, it's always a shopkeeper who is a man. But even as you're driving on the road, the men are the ones who are selling. And on a big pole, when you stop at the stoplights, the men are selling women's underwear. And you will see the men coming up to buy women's underwear, and you're thinking, this is so weird. But what I love was this man was buying a bra for, I assume, his wife. But he took it off the pole and he put it on him to see if he looked like it fit. And so it's so bizarre. You just have to love it and have to laugh about it. But they are very different globally. But many places, Muslim men do the shopping rather than Muslim women. And then the rights of women. Most of you probably know that very few women, Muslim women, drive in like Saudi, places like that. They don't hold public office. It's very rare for a Muslim woman to have authority over any man in a business situation or an office. It's changing some, but that's pretty common. A Muslim woman can earn about one-third to one-half of an inheritance from her family, whereas the brother would get a whole inheritance from the family. A girl child would get much less if she got anything. It's very important for a Muslim woman to have a child. And so from a very young age, she is encouraged to prepare herself for marriage. She's taught how to be a good wife. And there's entire books in Arabic and English on how to be a proper Muslim wife. You can go online even and find the rules for being a good wife. But in her mind, she is always thinking, I will get married and I will have a child. One of my dearest neighbors in Jordan had a degree in engineering. She worked hard in university. But when she got married, her job, she never even thought about her degree anymore. She was in the home, always preparing for her husband to come home. When she had a child, she shared with me her biggest fear was now that he would find another wife because he would be tired of her. Fear is a huge part of a Muslim woman's life. And they're always afraid they will not get married. Many Muslim women are still the father, the uncles, the family plans their wedding. It's a set marriage that's probably orchestrated from early age. In many places like Afghanistan, they use marriages to bond tribes, just like what you have heard about in history, maybe even in America, where we would bind these tribes together. The women are always afraid they will not get married, that they will not have a child, that they'll be barren. And then they're afraid that their husbands will bring another wife or will find another wife. Do you know how a man can be divorced in Islam? Anybody know that?
Three times.
And if they have witnesses that say that you're divorced, you're divorced. And so in like Saudi, Dubai, the Gulf states, many Muslim men will divorce their wives on Thursday, fly to another country, take a wife for the weekend, have a great time, come back, divorce that woman, and marry this woman again. And so the woman is always fearing that this is going to happen. And in many places, a man will have a wife in one city, and he might have a business in another city, and he'll have a wife in another city. And so these are issues that she's always thinking about. She feels in her heart that she is a second-class citizen. And it's from day one that she is taught her role in the family and in the society. All right, we mentioned hospitality. These things I've mentioned before might make you really sad. But I hope that you have the opportunity to meet a Muslim woman and learn how to be hospitable from her. She has some of the greatest gifts in hospitality. How many of you have eaten a meal in a home of a Muslim? Tell me what it was like.
They serve you everything. You don't move. They get everything for you. You sit still and they won't let you do anything.
That's right. That's so right. And how long did the meal last?
Very long.
Were you prepared for it? Had somebody told you you're going to be there a while?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. What did you eat?
Delicious vegetables
and
beets. Very good.
Yeah. And did you feel like you were in the way? I mean, were you an interruption in her life? I think that's what I love the most. You can knock on a Muslim woman's door at any time of day, and it will be like she was expecting you. She'll drop everything, and you are her focus. Now, I promise you, she might leave the room and go pray for a while And she might leave you sitting there while she goes fix tea, and you're thinking, okay, what do I do now? But, you know, I always take those opportunities to begin to pray for that house. But, yeah, she really knows how to be hospitable. One of my dear friends who was in Indonesia, she said, I could never outdo them. They were always outdoing what I was preparing or how I served them or how I was trying to make them feel welcome. And so what she finally did, she realized she was not going to outdo them. And there was no way but that she could be a friend and that God had given her gifts that they didn't have and that she needed to share them. But what she learned to do was get a Tupperware container, and it had little sections in it, and she would put little snacks that she knew that they liked, and she would keep it in her cupboard. So anytime they came, she was prepared. And she knew that it wouldn't look anything like how they would prepare it, because they would bring it on nice dishes and all that. But they were so overwhelmed that she had learned what they liked that they built a good relationship with her. When you move to a Muslim country, often they don't welcome you to the area. And you kind of sit in your home and you think, now how am I going to meet them? But in their countries, the person who moves to the country is the one who goes to meet their neighbors. So I figured this out when we moved to our new apartment building. I was going to go take a snack to each one of the houses so I could meet the ladies behind those doors. Well, my neighbor across the hall was my first trip. I knocked on the door. She peeked out the door. Well, first she peeked through the little peek hole to make sure who I was, that I wasn't a man. And then she opened the door, and I said, we're the people that live across the hall, and I want to give you this. I learned later she threw that immediately in the trash can because she had no clue whether I had used, you know, in my home alcohol or if I had used dishes that had cooked pork. But just the idea, well, within 20 minutes after I got home, there was a knock on my door. Well, I didn't have a peek hole, so I opened the door, and there she was with my dish that I had carried to her house with something that she had made. And my neighbor finally, after a few weeks, came to me and she said, you've got to stop bringing me dishes because I can't keep up with you. Because in their culture, once you take something, then they're obligated to return something to you. But it's a great way to meet women. And I challenge you, even on your college campus, if you don't have a kitchen or whatever, find a way to take something to a Muslim woman on your campus and see what happens. Welcome them to your house, to your community, to your dorm, wherever they are. We had a friend in a southern state as we were coming to share at our church. We were going to talk about how to share with Muslim women. And she decided she was going to find all the internationals in her community. And as her husband was the missions pastor at the church, so she took on this challenge before we got there. And she went all over her town. It wasn't a really big town, but she went to the hotels where these foreigners, internationals were working. She went to the gas stations. She found every place she could that internationals were, and she had three questions to ask them. She said, have you ever met a Christian? Now remember, this is in the South, so you know there were Christians in that area. Have you ever been told about Jesus? And thirdly, what are your emotions? What are your feelings about living in our city? She said the response was overwhelming that they said, no, we've never met a Christian. They'd lived there, some of them, for 20 years. She said they told her, no one has ever told us about Jesus. And thirdly, they said, this is the loneliest place we have ever lived. The biggest emotion for people who are from other countries who come to America, and I promise you, every Muslim woman who is in your city feels this. They are lonely. Remember, they live in community where they're from, so when they come to our areas, they're looking for friends. They're looking for community. But hospitality is something that they grow up with, and I promise I will never meet their standards. But I know that if their love language is hospitality, I need to practice hospitality. please jump in if you have stories you want to share or ideas or thoughts. But I hope that you're thinking toward what we're going to talk about with barriers and bridges. One of the things we learn as we learn languages is that parables and proverbs and stories from their culture help us learn culture probably more than anything else. And so a few of those I'm going to share with you. This is one of them that always troubles me. A woman's heaven is under the feet of her husband. I think you can picture what she's feeling, what she's thinking. In most Muslim homes that we've visited, we might never see the woman of the house. She may never come in the room where I'm sitting. And as a person who really wants to meet Muslim women, that really bothers me often. But I promise you that in many homes we've been in where I've never met the wife, and because I can speak English and the men accept me because I'm from the West and I'm just different, that woman is listening to what's being said. And so often the way we witness and share is through the men, not face-to-face with women. And then the women will seek us out separately where they're not under the thumb of the men in their house. There's a proverb, and you may know it, in Turkey that talks about a story that talks about a hill that's going down the hill, and all the men are in a wagon heading to paradise, and it's all running downhill, so the wagon's moving quickly. But behind the wagon are all the women running after the wagon, trying to get on to try to get to paradise. In her mind, the way that she earns paradise are through the male members of her family, through her children, and how well she educates her children to be good Muslims. But she will not know until she dies whether she gets to enter paradise. And that's pretty much a standard for all Muslims. But for Muslim women, she is always on that yearning to be able to make her qualities able to be in paradise. It's said in the Quran that very few women will be in paradise. And so these are things that she is taught from early on. This proverb is an interesting one. A man loves first his son, then his camel, and then his wife. It's expected that a Muslim woman will bear a male child. And usually she's blamed if there's not a male child. Now, you all know that's probably not the reason, but in her mind, she's taught that she needs to have a man who is a child in her family. In Dubai and in Jordan and places like that, if you have a male child, there is a big party. It's a huge party. They have stores in these places that you can go and buy balloon arrangements or flower arrangements. So in the hospitals where the women deliver, outside the door in the maternity area, if you've got a boy baby, you put the huge balloon arrangement around the door. It takes up the whole hall. You can't get through the halls without knocking the balloons. And then if it's a girl, it's a little, just a small arrangement or a small celebration going on. Even though every mother wants to have a daughter, she very much yearns to have community with a daughter. But a man loves first his son, then his camel, and then his wife. When we first went to Somalia, there wasn't much to brag about. It was all desert, so you know. And in most of Africa where we had lived, you could buy baskets and you could buy carvings and beautiful artwork. But when you got to Somalia, all you had was desert and camels. So what did we do? We started taking pictures of camels. And my husband went to the desert to help build a hospital. And while he was there, there was a big camel train going across the desert. And he stopped the man who was the herdsman leading the camels. And you always ask permission. Can I take a picture of your camels? Well, he became so angry. And he said, "No, sir, you can't take a picture of my camels. Because if you do, they'll get sick and they'll die. But here's my wife and my children. Would you like to take a picture of them?" Well, at first I was really angry at this man who would tell us that, because why would his camels die from taking a picture and then his wife and children not die? And he said, later on as we grew to love Somalis and learn from them, we realized if the camels die, the whole village dies. Everybody dies because that's their only livelihood, their only support. Everything about the camel supports them. The hides are for their homes. They eat camel meat. They eat the hump. They fry the hump, which is, it's fat. It's like Crisco, you know, like laying a slice of Crisco on the fire. They drink the milk. They eat the cheese. Everything about them is what they live on. And so we learn the layers of livelihood, because what in his mind, he can always get more wives and more children, but he can't earn enough to get more camels. So, all right, let's talk just a few minutes about what Muslim women believe. A lot of what they believe is what they've been told, and that's probably how you have started, many of you. What you've been told by your parents, by those who are your mentors, that's what you believe. And so for a Muslim woman, she really doesn't think a lot about what she believes. She just believes because she's been told that. My neighbor, Sahu, she would spend hours telling me what she believed, and I would tell her what I believed, and she would always say, well, I can't believe that because that's not what I was taught to believe. And so just the idea that she would change what she believed is very foreign to her, because most of what she believes is through the men of her family, and to change that would mean to dishonor her family. For many Muslim women, I really believe they don't believe they have a soul that's competent. And so they can't make a decision to do something different because that's not the way she is. She's been taught all her life that the way that she prays, the way that she lives, is because of what the men have decided for her. Now, I always wonder about Muhammad, because he really got to do what he got to do because of his wife. His wife was a very wealthy businesswoman, and she lived to support him. And so he could wander off in the rocks and have visions and dreams and get the Quran from Gabriel. But in the history of Islam, it has changed. Many women do not ever go to the mosque. If you ask them if they've ever been to the mosque, it will be very rare for most of them. They may have a section of the mosque that's set aside for women, but most areas of the world where we've been, she does not go. How many times a day do Muslims pray? Five times a day. Very rarely will you meet a Muslim woman who is that devoted, that she will pray five times a day. But she's taught that her prayers mean a lot more if they're inside the inner sanctum of her home, rather than out in public. And so that way she doesn't even think about going to the mosque. Most of the times they love to communicate, and where they communicate are at parties and weddings where they're all women in a room. How many weddings did you get to attend?
Six.
And how long did they last?
3 days.
They were, yeah. You want to describe it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depended on the wealth of the family. Poor families are a little bit different than wealthy families. But it starts, like, my favorite night is henna night. It's just girls sitting around gossiping and watching Noor, a great soap opera. Have to get into it. And you're just getting henna. Like, they hire women, or for the poorer families, they'd have girls in their family that would just do henna, your whole arms, your feet.
Does everybody know what henna is?
Oh, yeah. You know, the henna tattoo, washes off after a while. And you just eat and eat.
You don't know? Oh, she's got it on her hand. Is it a story?
No, not this one.
Okay, good. Thank you for being our example.
So you eat all kinds of, especially Morocco. Moroccans love sugar. Just love it. So you just eat cookies nonstop. You drink ridiculous amounts of tea. And you just hang out and talk all night. That's kind of the first night. The second night, depending on how modern the family is, sometimes there's men there, sometimes it's men and women with another. And again, you eat, and you drink a whole lot of tea, and you just dance. And that's almost, I don't think I've ever seen that with men and women, where you're dancing together.
Right.
But, I have, but you know, you hear like belly dancing or Middle Eastern dancing. That is what it is, and you're white and don't know how to do that, they will just move you.
Or they'll tell you to sit down and say, you're hopeless.
I didn't do that, unfortunately. I had people grabbing my hips. I'm like, oh, you move your hips this way. I'm like, I don't know you. Whatever. So, you know, that's the whole second night. And the last night in a Moroccan wedding is more dancing. And the whole time is loud music that you can hear forever. But so the last night, the husband brings, like, the dowry, and they, like, parade it in with either camels or horses or in the city's cars. And it's clothes, it's food, it's, for the wealthy families, it actually is, like, money. And electronics was a big thing in Morocco.
And jewelry?
Jewelry is huge. Really gaudy. Yellow gold.
Big gold.
And, like, orange gold. Like, really, like, wild gold. More loud music. They bring in a couple of these cool chairs. Well, they look a little terrified, like they're going to fall. And you eat more, and you drink more tea, and brides change dresses. Depending, again, wealth, like anywhere from like 3 times for some of my poorer friends to, like one wedding I went to, I think she changed 12 times. Just constantly changing. And they sit there. And they're not supposed to smile. They're sitting next to their future spouse. Just, you know, people are taking pictures with them and as they sit there. And yeah, it's just a blast. And you do that for 3 straight days, and then you go home and sleep for 3 more.
Did you know the bride in all 6 of the weddings? Mm-hmm. In one of our countries, it's really an honor to have a Westerner at the wedding. So you can be living in that country and not even know the family, and they will knock on your door and ask you to come to their wedding as a Westerner, because that's such a great honor. And so we've had ladies who have gone to hundreds of weddings. Now remember, 3 days. This one lady that I love so much, she went to maybe 100 weddings in 3 years. Now, she may not have gone to all the whole 3 days, especially if she didn't know anybody. But what she learned to do, and I'm jumping ahead, but I love to talk about how they love weddings. She began to tell a Bible story to the lady that would sit next to her. Well, it got to be quite a joke, because it never failed. That woman would stand up and say, this Western woman has a story for us all. Now remember, it's not a room of 20 people. It's a room of 100 or more. And will you tell us this story? And so she would tell the story to the entire room. She shared the gospel so many times with women at weddings. And what I love about women, we don't keep things to ourselves. Those stories were repeated over and over and over. That's a fun way to think about if you ever get to go to a wedding. Always have a story in your back pocket. God will use it. But the faith issues are huge. And there's not a magic wand that's going to help you get over helping a woman realize that she has self-worth. What you've got to do on your college campuses as you go is model that self-worth. If you are dealing with self-worth issues and you want to share Christ with Muslim women, you need to work on your self-worth and be able to model that you are a child of God and you have worth and you have joy. And no matter what Satan has done to you in your past, you can be that child of God. And so I challenge you to live in that self-worth and model that for Muslim women who've been taught their whole life, you're a second-class citizen. This is another saying. This was written by a Western worker back in the 1890s, early 1900s, but it still holds true a lot today. Samuel Zwemer was a missionary, and what I've heard is in 40 years of work, he saw 10 Muslims come to faith. That's a lot of years and a lot of work. But what he did, he stirred people from the West and said, Muslims deserve to hear about Jesus. And that raised a whole generation of people like you who are ready to go and share Christ. It may be that you'll never go to a Muslim country, but God's bringing Muslims to America. They are here. I want to share a neat way that I'm challenging, especially older women in America who are afraid of Muslims. I challenge them, and they're in your churches. And one of the ways you can help them is to begin to just challenge them to start praying that God will change their hearts, but also help them love Muslims. But I tell them when they go to the supermarket to pray as they enter the door that God will lead them to somebody to talk to. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but when I go to the supermarket, I'm in a hurry. I've got three things I've got to get, and I don't slow down long enough to meet anybody. But it's a great place to meet people. And then I challenge them to hover on the international food aisle, because that's where Muslim women and internationals are gonna go. And then I say, go to those things on that aisle that you have no clue what they are, that you know that Muslims or whoever you're trying to talk to cook, like couscous. Stand right there and then pull it off the rack and say, I don't know how to fix this. And to that Muslim woman that's standing there, say, can you teach me how to cook this? I promise you, she will invite you to her house and she will teach you. But those are some, that's one quick way of meeting people. I know it, when you're in college, you don't have a lot of time, so you may want to go to an international supermarket where you're sure that you're going to meet internationals. But be dumb. Be stupid. I think a lot of times we go overseas and we act like we know everything. Well, we don't. And if we can act like we don't know everything, I think God can use us.
Jump in.
Sure.
I probably learned how to make mint tea 100 times in 3 years. And because that's something that it's a huge cultural thing.
It is.
And, oh, let me teach you how to make tea. I'm never going to say, oh, someone already taught me.
Because the way she makes it is not going to be the way the other 100 have been.
100 times it was different.
Yeah, yeah.
Equally good, but different.
But be a learner. John did a great job of reminding us today. Be a learner. All right, before I go further on my barriers, what barriers did you hear? What were some of the reasons that, yeah?
When you said that they're, like, in community a lot, so if they're never alone, that's, like, how I connect with people, like, being alone with someone and having a conversation. And it's, like, scarier to be, like, oh, hey, 30 people, or, like, even, like, 5 that I know do not want to hear what I have to say, like try to connect with them in a personal way whenever it's better for both people. I feel like that would be different.
That's a good one. And some hints on how we can work through this is if you're visiting in a home and there's 30 people in the room, one-on-one. And don't even think that all 30 of those are listening to what you're saying. So use your gifts, but also you're multiplying your gifts. The thing that's happening, especially across Northern Africa and the Middle East, we're realizing that unless people come to faith in community, it will not grow because persecution will be even more severe. So we're learning how to share families to families. And singles are always part of a spiritual family. So don't feel like we're saying you can't be part of this. Because if you don't go as family to family, they're never going to see what a Christian family looks like. They'll never know how to model that in their home. And we want the gospel to go deep in a whole family, like Cornelius and his whole household. So your idea is great. As you're sharing with that one, you're witnessing also to the whole family. We have a dear friend who was a Muslim and a very strong Muslim, and she began to have dreams and visions. And the Holy Spirit just gave her an inkling of how to share, because every morning after she'd have a dream, she'd share it with her whole family. So by the time a year passed and she had met Western people, she had heard the gospel, she'd seen the Jesus film, as she followed in her journey to Christ, she shared it with her family the whole time. So when she finally became a Christian, it wasn't a surprise to them. In fact, several of her family came to faith with her because she had not been afraid. And often when we pull people aside and we only share with one person, we're teaching them that, oh, this is the only way you can share. So being open, not taking someone off to the side only. Now, sometimes when you're doing discipleship, you need to have one-on-one intimate times, but the more you can do it in a group, the gospel will go. But that's a good, that's a great barrier that we're working on. How do we get over? Other barriers that you thought of?
I think what we ran into in Senegal was that the women, just since they don't feel like they have any self-worth, they don't feel like they can't, well, because of the persecution, they can't accept it. They want to believe it, but they're not willing to give up what it takes to believe it. And that was, I mean, probably the biggest thing. And then, but they did believe it, and we were teaching them the stories. They didn't think they could learn it because they thought they were dumb. They thought they weren't smart enough to do it.
Wow. So what did you do?
We separated the men and the women, and that really, they became more vulnerable to us, and they started to actually share. Even the younger ones started to share, the young women. And the funny thing was that the women caught on faster than the men did.
That's
and,
right.
And they still thought that they couldn't do it. And but when we brought them back together, the women that we knew had the story down, they would not share it with their husband. In some places they would. In one place we went, there was a woman who was just so well respected that she was over her husband. And that was something so rare that you don't see ever. And she shared, and she did it. And we took her to other villages with us, and she showed the women how to do it too. And so it really helps for them to hear from someone that is of their own culture that I'm a woman, and I did this, and you can do this too, and you do have self-worth.
That's right. Good. Good. Other barriers?
I have a friend that I grew up with who, in college, met a Muslim man and became a Muslim. And I've noticed the biggest barrier is that she won't ever meet with me outside of their home. And when he knows that I'll be at the house, he's there. He'll at least drop by or just things like that.
Wow. That's really, yeah. That's a disease of American women right now, is how many of them are marrying Muslim men. I think it's a strategy that Muslim men have of drawing us away from what we've grown up with. And
she was my pastor's daughter.
In Egypt, Muslim men pretend to be followers of Jesus to woo Christian girls away and marry them off, and then their parents never see them again. And it's so many times it's the pastor's daughters. So just be aware, it's a strategy. They do have the gift of woo. They do, yeah, and especially the wealthy ones who have money. They bring you perfume and the gold jewelry, and they're always figuring it out how to.
Some are nose charming. They just yell at you.
Well, that's true. That's true. And hiss. Those are the ones we don't we walk on the other side of the street. Other barriers that you thought of.
So I'm actually from Malaysia, which is a Muslim country, and the government actually controls us not to spread gospel to the Muslim people. So I never had the chance or never did to actually talk about Jesus
to Muslim people.
Yeah, so I have no idea how to start to talk to them.
But you know what I love about Malaysia is God is stirring the hearts of Christians that they've begun to figure it out. So I would love to talk to you. I love Malaysia, and I appreciate your honesty. It is against the law to share Christ, your faith in Malaysia. And so for centuries, it's been divided up. And I'm thinking of a story I want to share, and I don't want to embarrass you, but one of our Muslim friends in Malaysia, she became a Christian, and she started attending the church. But they didn't know she was a former Muslim. And one day they found out, and they told her she had to leave, because if the government found out she was there, they would close the church. So you've got a huge task before you, and I pray that God will give you a partner who will help you learn how to cross that huge barrier that you've lived with your whole life. Wow. Thank you. other barriers. I'm going to share a few of them very quickly because I want to focus on the bridges. But the traditions of ministry, normally in the past, probably about 20 years ago, when we went to the mission field from the West, we normally thought if the man went out and shared his faith with the Muslims in the area, then he would go home and tell his wife. Well, that wasn't true. They never went home and told their wife. Often they went home and declared faith for their wife. And so she was never given an opportunity to follow Jesus on her own. So when he was martyred for his faith, she would go back to the mosque and turn in the names of all the believers that she knew. And so the martyrdom for believers was increased because of the women. And we're learning that we've got to share equally with the men and the women, and faith has to grow in both of them. So faith went through their home. We have to deal with the soul issues. We've mentioned that. Cultural barriers. There's not just cultural barriers when you go to a new country. There's cultural barriers between men and women in that country and how she is expected to live. And so we have to be willing to lay down some of our feelings of, you have the right to be a woman here. And maybe until we're willing to lay down some of our thoughts of human rights, will we be able to cross the barriers of just the fact that women don't have any rights in some of these places.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by soul issues?
That was their feeling that they don't, that their soul is not adequate to believe in God, to talk to God without a man intercessor. So that's kind of the soul issue that I was speaking of. Morality, you and I need to learn the stories. If we don't know the stories of the Bible, and you know, I thought, oh, I know these stories. I've heard these stories all my life. But then when I tried to tell them, whoa, I blew it. So I really had to practice telling stories. I would suggest on your campus you start a story group. And as women, you all begin storying those stories together. And maybe once you get a few down, you invite somebody who is not a believer to come and say, we're practicing. Can you come practice with us and listen to us? So those are some ideas. New moms, I challenge them to get that little storybook that they tell their children, that they read to their children. And I say, you know, the first night, read it. Second night, you have to tell it. And the third night, your children have to tell it back to you. Just hearing the stories and learning the stories. And being able, you don't have to have them perfect, but do you have the details that will help the person hear the story and then be able to repeat it? Any other barriers you've thought of? I've got just a few more minutes. All right, let's look at some bridges. First of all, we've got to check our attitudes. Are we fearful of Muslims? What are our feelings toward Muslims? Are we willing to have them in our homes? Are we willing to go to their houses? For Thanksgiving this year, a friend of ours and Nick and I, we went to their house and we invited an Afghan family for Thanksgiving. They brought 25 people to Thanksgiving. Now we have 1 million invites. We can go anywhere almost in Virginia because a lot of them have connections. But, you know, that's one of the greatest ways we can break down the barriers of being able just to have relationships. Women to women and families to families, I mentioned this. It's going to be you sharing with a Muslim woman or a Muslim woman sharing with another Muslim woman. Always as you're discipling and sharing Christ, you're talking about how do you multiply what I've said to you. If I tell you a story, who are you going to share it with? Who do you want to tell it to? And then families to families. And remember, you as singles are always part of our family. Then we've got to figure out how are we going to connect. If they're in community, they're always in community, how are we going to get to them? And find ways to gain access. Go to a Muslim-owned business. I'm going to give you a website. It's called IslamicFinder.org. And it is a Muslim-run website, but it lists all the businesses, all the restaurants, all the mosques, all the women's centers in a certain geographical area. And all you have to do is put your zip code in and put in 10 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles, and it will list all the places, all the doctors, everything. We went to a church and we shared this, and the lady came as she was leaving. She said, I've got to change what I've been doing. She said, I had decided I was going to boycott every Muslim business in my community, and I would not go in the door. And she said, today I heard that that's how I'm supposed to share Christ with them, and I have to ask forgiveness. So that's a great tool. And you may be in a very small community, and it's not there, but somewhere in your state there's a larger community, and maybe you can find some connections. Restaurants are the greatest places to find connections, and drinking mint tea always opens the door. And coffee if you're from Turkey. Take opportunities that you have. Host events away from church buildings. Often the church building becomes the target where we think we'll invite them to church. Well, usually they can come one or two times, and then either the men in their community, the imams, the sheikhs, will tell them they can't come back. So if you're doing ESL, if you're doing things like that, try to find other places rather than church buildings that makes it difficult for them to build relationships long term with you. And then there's some tools. There's never a magic tool, I promise you, but here are a few tools. Anybody not know any of what we're talking about? Songs. I would suggest in your dorm rooms, in your apartments, you've always got Christian music playing, so that if an international Muslim arrives, they're always hearing it and it softens their heart. Oral tools. We've mentioned the henna. If you don't know about henna storying, you might want to get online and look at the stories. It's a way of having the henna on your hand and telling a Bible story using the henna. A lot of times in the airport, you'll see that a Muslim woman will have henna on, and you turn over your henna, and she'll automatically allow you to tell the story of the woman at the well, of the woman with the issue of blood. Those are great tools just to help conversations start. The Karanji Cube is a tool that some people in Egypt developed to use the verses that are in the Quran that point to Jesus, and they use it just like the Evangie Cube, but it's a tool that you have in your hand that a lot of times helps you just bridge those first minutes of awkwardness in conversation. And then, of course, the big one is to pray for dreams and visions. If you don't have Muslim women in your area, if you don't know them, every day, just ask that somewhere God is revealing himself through dreams and visions. Then finding those women and families of peace that can open doors, I promise you they will invite you and they will introduce you to somebody. They may not be the ones who will come to faith, but through them you will meet people who will come to faith. And then figure out how are you going to gather them. Women like to be together. Have a party at Christmas. And tell the Christmas story to a group of women. Automatically, you've got a group of women who will listen to your stories. But prayer is our biggest tool. Those are just some things I challenge you to pray for. If you've never done a prayer tea, a Muslim women's prayer tea on your college campus, it'd be a fun thing to do. If you want information on how to do one, I'll be glad to do it, or you can go on the International Mission Board site website and look up Muslim Women Prayer Tea, and it gives you some tools. It's a way to spend a few hours together, and the whole focus is to pray for Muslim women. So that's a fun way to be together and pray together. Any questions, comments? Those of you who've been with Muslims, you might have some more to add. That's all right. I hope y'all realize we're using our pen names in public, so you've heard Nick blow it a couple times.
It's so hard not to be saved in perspective. A lot of what Ruth is talking about is true internationally, but it's very much true here. In Denver, I work with Muslims, not vocation, I'm an engineer, but we have a lot of Muslim stuff going on in Denver. We have about 50,000 Muslims in Denver. And it's the same barriers or the same barriers you see for out in the neighborhood that affectionately by some, less affectionately by others, is nicknamed Saudi Aurora. There's so many opportunities here, particularly with immigrant women. Syria, we have a lot right now, Iraq, Somalia. They want to know, what does this piece of mail mean? Or how do I sign up my kids for free lunch at school because we can't afford to feed our kids? And there's so many opportunities that women just, because you speak English natively, most of us, you can just be a blessing in that way. At the same time, you learn from them, learn how to cook, learn how to make tea, learn whatever. There's so many women who are just longing for some woman to come alongside them and just help them live here. Mm-hmm. Because they have no idea how. So that's my opinion.
Yep.
Sorry, advertisement.
No. I love that. And I love what you said. You chose to live in an area where you could walk out your door and be with Muslims.
The neighbors across my hall are from Chad. They're Chadian Arabs. I have three families on my building from Eritrea. I have Somalis on my block. And I live down the street from a mosque with 19,000 people.
Wow.
And I don't live, I mean, I live by myself, but I also have teammates that were also in North Africa with me, living across the street, and we live there on purpose. And it's fun because you're the whitey, and they're so curious. Why are you in our neighborhood? And just let people be curious. And when kids want to play with your hair because it's different than theirs, whatever. But so many people here that are, they're longing for the, they don't understand the longing for the gospel. And they're ultimately longing for a relationship with God. And you find that relationship through relationship with another woman.
That's so perfect. And so what I challenge you, when you get out of university, maybe God's not going to take you overseas. He's got a place for you to live. As you go to that community, find where those people are and rent your apartment there, live there. It's really a great way. We always say the two things you need to do is figure out when you go overseas, but also in America, the place you live and the language you learn. And that will open doors for you.
And if you have like no idea how to do that, just pray for it. Because I know, and a bunch of our teams this summer came back from South Asia. Like, the boys were just so eager. Like, they just had a heart for these Muslim men, and they just asked God to show them. Like, and then someone ran. They just came to the Christian Challenge. Like, we don't even know where they came from.
There you go.
Just like brought them there. And so he'll.
Prayer is the key.
Around the memorial level.
That's right. You all have been an encouragement to me and a blessing. And I pray that over the next years you find so many friends that you can share Christ with, whether they're Muslims or Hindus or from anywhere in the world. But in my heart, I'd like them to be Muslim women. Let me pray for you. Our Father, we've gone over time, but that's all right, because when we walked in this room, we had no clue what you were going to say into our lives. But Lord, you have blessed us as we've thought about these women around the world who really probably have no opportunities to hear. But because these women are right here and have a heart for them, they will hear. And so, Father, bless them. Give them encouragement. Give them hours in the day where they can get away from studies and other jobs and things and really get out and seek those people you want them to meet. And I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all. One other thing, if you've never watched the video Magdalena, that would be a great tool to have in your toolbox. It's the Jesus film, but it's for women. And it's a really great tool. You can get it on Amazon, or you can go to the Campus Crusade website. But Magdalena is a great tool. There's a new one that's coming out, so kind of keep your eye open. And I forgot what it's called. But God is putting tools in our hands to use among Muslim women, which were not there before. So thanks.